Macmillan Audio presents Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Written and read by John Waters. Prologue. Going my way? I haven't felt this excited or scared for a long time, maybe ever. I just signed a book deal resulting from the shortest pitch ever. I, John Waters, will hitchhike alone from the front of my Baltimore house to my co-op apartment in San Francisco and see what happens. Simple, huh? Am I fucking nuts? Bridget Berlin, Andy Warhol's most dangerous and glamorous 60s superstar, recently said to me, "How can I be bad at 70? She's got a point. I mean, yes, I'm between pictures, as they say in Hollywood. But long ago, I realized, as a so-called cult film director, not only did I need a plan B that was just as important to me as movie making, I needed a plan C, D, and E. But plan H for hitchhike? I'm 66 years old, for Christ's sake. Why would a man who has worked so hard his whole life to reach the level of comfort you have put yourself in such an uncomfortable position?" Marion Boesky, my New York art dealer, asked me when I told her of my undercover travel adventure, as the publishers were calling my new book and trade announcements. A one-time actor in my early films who had a recent homeless past was even more alarmed when I hinted that I might do a hitchhiking book. "You'll never get a ride," he warned, telling me he had tried hitchhiking himself out of necessity in Florida last year. "No one picks up hitchhikers these days," he griped with disgust. "No one!" Even successful hipsters seemed shocked when I confided my plans. "Nice knowing you," a California photographer buddy muttered with a laugh over dinner, when he realized he wouldn't see me again until after my hobo-homo journey was scheduled to be completed. God, I wondered grandiosely, would I be like JFK on those recently released secret White House tapes where he was heard planning his first day back from Dallas before anyone knew he'd be assassinated, commenting on what a tough day that would be if he only knew. What am I trying to prove here? I mean, I'm not bored. An ex-convict woman I recently met claimed her criminal past was not a result of a bad childhood, but just because she wanted an adventure. I do, too. Kicks. But hasn't writing and directing 15 movies and penning 6 books made me feel complete? My career dreams already came true years ago, and what I do now is all gravy. Shouldn't I be retiring rather than sticking out my thumb? Retiring to what, though? Insanity? Will I be safe? I know serial killers routinely pick up hitchhikers and murder them, but aren't the victims, unfortunately, usually young female hookers? Yeah, I know about Herb Baumeister, the I-70 strangler, who choked at least 16 gay men to death. But he picked them up in gay bars, not on exit ramps of truck stops. Yet I must admit, even truckers I know are fairly nuts. One of them must have raised a few of my neighbor's eyebrows when he came over to visit and parked his 18-wheeler right on the small, quiet residential street in front of my house, taking up half the block. He's funny and sexy and straight, but a real freak, and likes to horrify me with his stories from the road. How he travels high on speed, picking up teenage runaways and screwing them in the back of a truck, or driving full speed ahead in the night, carrying a bag of someone else's clean urine prepared for any random drug test as he masturbates into a sock. He laughs when he admits sometimes illegally dumping huge loads of gravel in the middle of an unsuspecting suburbanite's lawn if he knows he's overloaded and a weigh station is coming up that will be open. Suppose somebody like this guy picks me up. Can I really give up the rigid scheduling I'm so used to in real life? Me, the ultimate control freak who plans weeks ahead the day I can irresponsibly eat candy? Sure, I've got all my interstate routes planned out for the trip, and I think I know how many truck stops there are and how far apart they are, but so what? Will I really get out of the car if my ride strays from my route but is still headed west? I keep thinking beggars can be choosers, but I have to open my mind to the possibility I may be wrong. "We are all bums," a radical left-wing poster boasted on the wall of my bedroom in my parents' house in the 60s. I remember the rage this particular slogan caused in my father. A bum. The worst thing you could be in his book. Now that he is sadly gone, can I finally become one? A vagabond? A freeloader? Is it possible to be a vagrant when you own three homes and rent another place in Provincetown for the summer? Will this book end up as a new spin on that now dated but incredibly influential 1961 nonfiction book, Black Like Me, where the white author, John Howard Griffin, hitched and rode buses through the South disguised as a black man to see how it feels to be discriminated against? I am afraid, just the way the Black Like Me man was, but of different things, like bad drivers. I'm amazed every person driving their car isn't killed every day, riding along at high speeds in lanes just a few feet from each other, texting, talking on the phone behind the wheel, or just plain driving while stupid. Nobody is really a safe driver. I worry my own involuntary backseat driving will cause problems for anyone who picks me up. Will cries of slow down or slamming imaginary brakes from the passenger side cause bad will with my host drivers? I'm never in the front seat of a car if I'm not behind the wheel, except when I take taxis in Australia, because I read the drivers there think you're snooty if you get in the back. Where I live in Baltimore, if you got in the front of a cab, they'd think you were robbing them and probably shoot you. I've had a good history with hitchhiking. It's hard to imagine today, but in the early 60s, my parents expected me to hitchhike home every day from high school. All the kids did. The roads were filled with preppy teenage boys, lacrosse sticks over their shoulders and their thumbs out. I'm sure just as many serial killers were behind the wheel then as now, but you never heard about them. Nobody warned us of the dangers of hitchhiking. Evil definitely did not seem to be lurking. Of course perverts were out there, and I hitchhiked every day with a hard-on, hoping one would pick me up and give me a blowjob. Many did. On this trip, I guess I'll still technically be horny while hitchhiking, but I may be carrying a Viagra in my pocket instead of an erection. Is all hitchhiking gay? Aren't truck stops and Levi-clad tough guy hitchhikers staples of porn movies? My planned route is I-70 West, and if I'm lucky enough to get a ride going that way, I'll be able to find out if there really is such a thing as the Kansas City Trucking Company. Or was that just the title of a fictitious garage in that classic gay film directed by Joe Gage? I saw the real El Paso Wrecking Corp on my drive from El Paso to Marfa, Texas, and almost drove off the road remembering the sequel. If there really is such a place, maybe I can get dropped off there and make friends. I drove all five cross-country interstate routes in the United States when I was a young man and loved it. We used to get drive-away cars, where the owner gave you the keys and you paid the gas and delivered the car to an address on the opposite coast. I even remember singing America the Beautiful, stoned on hashish, with my fellow travelers, David Lockery, Steve Buto, and David Hartman, as we drove toward a beautiful sunset in Minneapolis. Looking back, I'm amazed anyone trusted any of us, considering how we looked at the time. But even though we violated the rules by taking other passengers and drugs, we always did deliver the car in one piece. But come to think about it, we didn't ever pick up a hitchhiker then, and that was in the heyday of the hippie years. And in 2012, I expect someone to stop? I still hitchhike in Provincetown to Longnook, the most beautiful beach in Truro, about 10 miles away. I usually ask someone to go on a thumbing date with me. Author Philip Hoare, artist and singer Kembra Fowler, the late and great art dealer Colin Deland have all joined me alongside the highway, and we've never had any real trouble either. Once I was hitchhiking with photographer Henny Garfunkel, whose extreme hairdo and stunning fashions can make children cry, and a man did a U-turn and picked us up, never a good sign. As usual, I got in the front and the woman hitchhiker got in the back. It smelled inside, like he was living in his car or something. I had a sudden flashback to the scene I wrote in Pink Flamingos where Mink Stole's character says to her husband, played by David Lockery, that she's tired of just driving around, looking for female hitchhikers to pick up, kidnap, and then have raped and impregnated so the babies could be sold on the black market. "See that safety sticker?" our vaguely creepy driver asked. "Yeah," I said hesitantly, looking at the Massachusetts official emissions test sticker on the inside of the windshield. "I drew that myself," he chuckled with a leer. I turned around to see Henny's wide-eyed look of panic, but it was all a false alarm. He dropped us off at the beach without incident. But sometimes I go alone, and I'm never sure if the drivers who pick me up recognize me. "Who is that man in the car?" a confused child who had never heard of hitchhiking once asked his mom and dad after I got in. Why is he in this car? He continued as I squirmed in embarrassment under the kid's hostile glare and tried to explain what hitchhiking was. Another time, a handsome long-haired pirate type stopped to give me a ride in his pickup. And just as I was about to jump in the front, he smiled and said, "No, you have to ride in the back. My dog's up here in the front." Ah! Suddenly put in my proper place around such rugged hippie good looks, I laughed and happily climbed up into the open truck bed. I was thrilled to get a ride with such a sexy devil, even if I could only see his beautiful long hair from the rear as he pulled off towards Provincetown. Even weirder was the time A&E Biography TV show was doing a segment on me and asked if they could shoot me hitchhiking in Provincetown, and I reluctantly said yes. The crew hid in the bushes, and when I got a ride, they jumped in their van and followed. The nice local fisherman who picked me up not only didn't recognize me, he didn't see the crew either. Nervously eyeing the cameramen hanging out their windows, shooting us as they tracked our car, I casually mentioned to my ride, "Don't look over now on your side of the car, but there's a film crew shooting this whole thing." "Okay," he said with a shrug, completely unimpressed, and then drove for 10 more minutes before dropping me off at the beach. Even when the crew jumped from their vehicle to film my exit, he never ruined their final shot by looking into the camera lens. What a pro. One time my hitchhiking date was Patricia Hearst. As we walked toward Route 6 from Provincetown, we quickly got a ride, but I don't think the driver recognized us until we got in, me in the front, her in the back. He kept doing double takes, looking over at me, and finally said, "Are you John Waters?" And I said yes, and at the same time he looked in the rearview mirror, and I said, "And that is Patty Hearst." He looked totally shocked, but I could tell he realized it was her. "He made me do it," Patty deadpanned, and I was so proud of her improvisational skills. We are now a hitchhiking comedy duo. Coming back to Provincetown that day with Patty was harder, because we had to hitchhike right on Route 6, a highway with cars whizzing by, which made it seem more like real hitchhiking. It took some time for us to get a ride, and I could tell Patty was starting to get nervous, especially when we were finally picked up but asked to switch cars by the driver, who hooked us up with another ride from a friend in North Truro, the next town before Provincetown. Later, her husband Bernie, whom I love but realize is the head of security for Hearst Corporation, was a little perturbed when she told him of our day's adventure. "Oh, come on, John," he said with impatience. "Hasn't she had enough trouble?" I guess he was right. But have I? Is there such a thing as unfamous? If so, that is what I want to be on this trip, yet go right back to being famous if need be. I'm recognized in public about 80% of the time across this country, but during the other 20% when I'm not, I get pissed when I realize how shabbily other people must be treated every day. When store clerks or airline reps do suddenly recognize me and get nice after being grumpy when they didn't know who I was, I get testy right back. How will my so-called fame or sudden lack of it affect my life as a bi-coastal tramp? Can slumming on the road or begging rides on interstate entrance ramps live up to my fantasy of being a David Niven from the gutter glamorous vagabond? Who could recognize me driving by at 70 miles per hour anyway? And even if they did, who would think, "Oh, that's John Waters, the filmmaker, alongside the road in the middle of Utah"? Once I climb in, will they believe it's me, even if they know who I am, or think I'm just a John Waters impersonator? Which I am, in a way, every day, only older. I will definitely carry a cardboard sign. That Depression-era gimmick has worked well for me in the past. Not San Francisco or bus, but I-70 West, with San Francisco on the other side, a double feature of Hitchhiking Please. Plus a backup sign that a friend actually saw a hitchhiker carrying in one of those pot-harvesting Northern California towns. I'm not psycho. Now there's a psychological profile that can stand alone. Of course, a scary driver might see that visual, chuckle to himself and think, "Well, I am," and pull over. But I will maintain my belief in the basic goodness of people. I am not going to set up ridiculous rules for myself in the hitchhiking adventure. I mean, I'll have money, carry credit cards and a cell phone, and plan to stay in motels if no one is kind enough to invite me to their family's home for a sleepover. No tourist sites, though, or visiting friends. This is an irrational vacation, not a tour. Some friends tell me that off the interstate, on the secondary roads, I'll have a better chance of being picked up because those drivers are hiding something. But am I anxious to get a ride with a drug dealer or a mule who is carrying kilos of heroin hidden in the chassis of his car? If I get stuck in the middle of the night, I'll do anything I have to do to survive, even call a limousine if necessary. One thing I know, I won't take a ride on a motorcycle. I imagine hitchhiker manners are a gray area. What if they're bad drivers? Do I offer to take over if they are falling asleep at the wheel and refuse to pull over for a nap? Suppose they won't let me. Hey, wake up, we'll get old quickly. And how many times can you grab the steering wheel in the nick of time after they nod off and begin to drift into the breakdown lane at full speed toward a family gathered around their vehicle while changing a flat? Oh, God, suppose I have to help change a flat. I have no clue how to do that. If I had to change a flat or die, I'd be dead. And what about sleeping myself while someone else drives? That somehow seems rude to me. Don't people pick up hitchhikers to have someone to talk to, lech after, vent to? Besides, if I fell asleep, they could easily turn off the main road, go to a secret satanic location, and cut off my head and put it on a stick. How do you say no if a car stops to pick you up on a lonely highway? You run a quarter of a mile to get in, and you see a gang of six tough black guys inside. See, I'm already racially profiling, and I feel guilty. They could be normal college students, couldn't they? Or 1960s freedom fighters lost in some mysterious Twilight Zone time warp. One of my favorite hip-hop groups. Even fans who recognize me from my old Court TV show, Till Death Do Us Part. But if they're not, and I smell trouble, what do I say? I'm doing a reality show, and there's a satellite camera filming us right now? Maybe they believe it. I guess what I'd really do is just chirp, "Hey, homie, thanks for stopping," before yelling shotgun and pushing the front seat passenger over to the middle without showing fear. Suppose it all goes wrong. Nobody picks me up. I'm robbed. Beaten. I will already have half the book advanced, so I can't quit. Should I put my hitchhiking dough in a special CD account I can't touch before I leave, just in case I chicken out? Would I have the nerve to call my editor, Jonathan Galassi, and tell him of my cowardice, my literary spinelessness? Just imagine the humiliation of my Pope of Trash Crown being so besmirched is enough to give me shingles, whatever they are. Or could I just make up the whole book and say it was true? How would anybody know? It took years for scholars to figure out that John Steinbeck's supposedly nonfiction Travels with Charlie in Search of America, a well-reviewed bestseller published in 1962 and still in print, was in fact total bullshit. Instead of driving cross-country in a pickup, staying in campgrounds, and chatting up the locals, as the author claimed, he actually had company with him, stayed in motels and luxury hotels, and made up the conversations. According to writer Bill Barrick, quoted in a recent New York Times article, Steinbeck was discouraged by everyone for making this trip. He was too old, trying to recapture his youth, the spirit of knight-errant. Uh-oh, could that be me? Nah, I don't think I could lie. I'm not sure I want to be J.T. Leroy at this stage of my life. And besides, being the centerpiece of a literary hoax is one of the few ways to be bad that is never funny. But why not take a chance? And before I go, think up the very best that could happen on this trip. Imagine the worst, too. Both as novellas. And then, after fantasizing on paper, go out in the world, do the real thing, and hopefully live to report the results. Fiction, nonfiction, then the truth. All scary. Go ahead, John. Jump off the cliff. The best that could happen. A novella. Good Ride Number 1, Harris. It's a beautiful Baltimore spring day, the perfect 68-degree morning. I decide to leave 24 hours earlier than everyone in my office thinks I will, so I can avoid all their nervous goodbyes. Susan, my longtime assistant, who runs my filth empire with an iron fist, has always thought this adventure a ludicrous idea, but knows I am just as stubborn as she can be, so she long ago gave up talking me out of it. Trish, my other full-time assistant, who will actually be transcribing this book, I write by hand on legal pads before she puts it on the computer, is a little friendlier to the idea since she was briefly a teenage runaway. Jill, my art helper, seems all for the idea. My bookkeeper, Dora Lee, has given up being surprised by anything that goes on in our office, but knows I will continue to get a receipt for every single penny I spend while hitching, since no one could argue this is not a business trip. Margaret, my housekeeper, laughed the hardest I've ever heard her, practically in my face, when I confessed my cross-country plans. Just before I walk out the front door to leave, I look out back and see the fox that lives on my property, happily roaming my wooded grounds, and take this as a good luck sign. I turn on the burglar alarm and leave feeling, well, adventurous. I walk up my small residential street and am relieved that none of my neighbors see me carrying a hitchhiking sign or question why I am on foot carrying an obvious travel bag. I get to the corner of Charles Street and stick out my thumb and hold up my I-70 West cardboard sign that Jill designed for me. Make the letters not too arty and certainly not stop me before I kill again scary, I had mentioned. And she has followed instructions well. I don't feel ridiculous. I feel kind of brave. I can't believe it. The very first car that goes by stops, and I run to hop in. An art school type dressed in brown jeans and an old Charles Theater t-shirt is behind the wheel of a car so nondescript that I have to ask him what kind it is. A very used 1999 VW Passat sedan, he answers in the kindest voice imaginable. I feel safe immediately. He doesn't even bat an eye that I'm hitchhiking, even though he recognizes me. Wow, John Waters, I'm a fan, he announces low-key. He so respects my privacy, he doesn't even ask where I'm headed, but offers, I'm going as far as West Virginia, if that's a help. It sure is, I say, relieved I can avoid the tricky cloverleaf where I-70 West meets the Baltimore Beltway, and there's nowhere to stand to bum a ride. Did you see Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void, he asks with the excitement of a real film fanatic? Of course! The best movie about taking drugs ever, I answer, so happy he wants to discuss other extreme pictures and not my own. I like the director's cut version best, my driver continues. It's more endless, like an LSD trip. I know Gaspar, I offer, and you'd be surprised after seeing his films, but he's really a sweet guy. I love fucked up movies, my fellow film buff enthuses, as he turns up the radio and what's playing? Hitchhike by Marvin Gaye. Unbelievable. Is it me, or do I smell ganja? I'm a little out of practice as a pothead. I used to smoke grass every day of my life around 1964 to 1972, but now only rarely because it just makes me worry about mundane things. But sometimes, in the summer in Provincetown on a Friday night when I have nothing to do the next day, I'll smoke a little weed and get launched, as my young friend and part-time pot smoker Frankie calls it, when I start ranting and laughing while stoned. And of course, I'm a good host. I have small stash of pot in all my places of residence in case guests might want to smoke. Legal amounts, I hope. I'm Harris, he finally introduces himself, and I silently think that's Divine's real first name. But keep it film zealot friendly rather than dreamland focused. Harris is a good-looking guy who seems laid back, something I have never felt like in my entire life. I'm thrilled my first ride is so seemingly uncomplicated. Are you a student at Maryland Institute, I asked, thinking college would be the perfect reason for him to be in Baltimore. No, I'm in business for myself, he says with a sideways glance that invites all sorts of speculation as we merge onto the Baltimore Beltway, headed in the right direction. Have you seen Armando Bo's films, I ask, feeling as if continuing our movie hound conversation is definitely part of my payment as a writer. I love his movies, Harris yells with enthusiasm as we head west on I-70, already on the first leg of my journey to San Francisco. Armando's been dead for many years now, but he deserves to be honored more, I shout over the music, and my highway host agrees. That Isabel Sarli was so hot. Those tits were real, you know, he hollers in mammary mania about the director's one-time mistress and the star of all his films. And she's still alive, I shout. 75 years old. I talked to her on the phone just recently, I brag, and I can tell he's impressed. You're kidding, Harris marvels in wide-eyed amazement. I really did, I answer, holding up my hand to silently swear to God. A South American trash film enthusiast hooked us up, and although her English was a little rusty, but way better than my Spanish, I got to gush how much her films like Fury, Fever, and Fuego meant to both Divine and me. How come you aren't making a movie? Harris suddenly asks with shy concern. I explain I had a development deal to make Fruitcake, a terribly wonderful children's Christmas adventure, wrote the script, and was about to make it, and then the recession happened, and the independent film business as I knew it fell apart. And now all the distributors and film financiers want the budgets to be under $2 million, which I can't do anymore. Well, I'll back it, he says nonchalantly. What do you mean? I sputter, not believing my ears. You can keep a secret, right? He whispers conspiratorially. Sure, I mumble, and I can, especially if it's a good one. I'm a pot dealer. Don't worry. There's none in the car. It's all on my West Virginia farm. But I've got plenty of cash. How much do you need? 5 million, give or take, I confide with a chuckle. Sure, Harris is pulling my leg. No problem, he says, beaming as if I had just asked him for spare change in Berkeley in the 60s. But surely you're not serious, I ask, thinking how could this be possible? I've been trying to raise this budget unsuccessfully for 5 years. It's no big deal, he says, as we cross into West Virginia, and I feel the thrill of illegal interstate financing. Maybe we could form a limited partnership, like I used to do in the old days, I offer. Nah, he responds good-naturedly. I'll just give you the cash and you pay me back if it ever breaks even. Cash, I think in alarm. $5 million in cash? Good God, how will I ever explain this to the IRS? I ask Harris in bewildered excitement. The feds don't ask where you got it, do they? He replies level-headedly. Just pay me back and I'll get the money laundered by a chain of nail salons I'm a silent partner in. Okay, I say in shock, not wanting to blow the deal if he was possibly serious. I'm so stunned by my new business partner that I don't even notice we've exited the interstate and are now driving on a country road. We're near, Harris explains, as he goes around the block a few times and zigzags back and forth on even smaller rural routes. I guess he's making sure we're not being followed, but I keep my newly greenlit mouth shut. Finally, we turn off on a beautiful dirt lane with a natural canopy of trees overhead, and then veer off an unmarked long driveway nestled in the hills of northern West Virginia and go about another half mile. Ahead of us is a lovingly restored but not overly yuppified 1850s farmhouse overlooking a pond with a waterfall gently cascading into it. Expansive trees and flowering plants surround the entire idyllic setting. His incredibly striking wife, barefoot already in May and dressed in a pair of fire engine red jeans and a long-sleeved black T-shirt, is watering the potted flowers on the outdoor patio. This is Laura, Harris introduces us, and of course you know John Waters and his films. She smiles a warm welcome, and I can't help but notice she smells like pot, too. I'm going to give him $5 million to make his new film, he casually mentions, and she doesn't look particularly surprised. Oh, that's sweet, Laura says, hardly looking up. From the pot of black tulips, my favorite kind, she just placed artfully on an outdoor table. We've been looking to invest in films for such a long time, she offers happily. I grin, but remain silent in stupefaction. I'll make us some lunch, offers Harris, before trotting up to the main farmhouse to prepare as Laura follows, eager to help. I just sit there in amazement at my good fortune. This is my first ride, and already I'm going to be back in the movie business. Harris and Laura soon return, and we feast on delicious chicken salad made from free-range birds that Laura confides she strangled with her own hands just this morning. After a dessert of freshly picked blueberries, Harris carefully folds his cloth napkins from Mardix, he proudly announces, a recently closed restaurant much loved by downtown Baltimore bohemians, and says, "Let's take a walk, John." I eagerly follow him to a remote point of his property, and Harris reveals that we are now going to dig up the cash. I keep my mouth shut. Oh, honey, he yells to Laura, call up that FedEx place and make sure our buddy gets his lazy ass to work. Tell him we got a special shipment coming up. Harris turns to me and asks gently, do you have a FedEx number? If not, we have a dummy one we can use. We're going to FedEx the money? I ask in awe, amazed that Harris plans on giving me the money now. Sure, he replies. You don't want to carry all that cash with you on your hitchhiking trip, do you? Well, no, I stammer, giving him the digits which I know from memory. Great, he says, jotting down the account information. We'll FedEx it directly to your address. On cue, Laura walks like a gazelle down from the house, carrying a stack of flat FedEx boxes ready to be assembled. She has a lovely, serene smile on her lips. Maybe this is the first of their millions they're giving away. You can tell philanthropy brings her a new kind of delight. Harris grabs a shovel from behind the naturally distressed original barn door and leads me to an even more distant part of his farmland that appears to be overgrown with vines. Here he announces as he pulls up several clods of phony earth covered in prop foliage and begins digging. Laura slips on a pair of rubber gloves. Harris hasn't even worked up a sweat before I hear the shovel clink on metal. Bingo, purrs Laura, as she gives me a friendly wink. Pay dirt, jokes Harris, as he begins to hoist up, with his thin but muscled arms, a small industrial safe of a combination lock. Laura hands me the first of the standard large FedEx boxes and gets out a pistol grip tape dispenser. She quickly notices from my panicked expression that I have no idea how to assemble these boxes and gently takes the packaging back. That's okay, she whispers gently. You deserve to be directing, not doing manual labor. Laura snaps the carton together in one swift motion and seals it with tape like Quick Draw McGraw and hands me back the box with the skill of a next-day delivery artisan. Harris drops the safe to the ground, and Laura swiftly dials the combination, and I avert my eyes, hoping to not look greedy or, worse yet, sneaky. Harris moves to another spot of earth about 30 feet away, rips up more fake turf, and starts digging again. I hear him whistling, "There's no business like show business," with surprising skill. "Here we go," Laura says softly to me as she opens the safe door and hands me the first bundle of $10,100 bills, which she assures me totals $1 million. It seems heavy to me, but she scoffs mildly and says, "It only weighs about 25 pounds. I've had to carry $3 million strapped inside baggy winter clothes at customs, and believe me, that's a backbreaker." But I never complain. Helping keep Americans high is never easy or without toil. "Here's more cash," Harris cheerfully announces as he manually raises a duplicate safe from another grave in the ground and spins the combination lock like a safecracker supreme. "This ought to pay for a lot of music rights," he chuckles happily to me, holding up the next $1 million in bills. "Won't Johnny Knoxville like getting paid in cash?" Laura asks with a kindness so rare in show business today. "He sure will," I agree, impressed that she is so well-read on my career that she knows whom I want to star in my next film. How we'll handle Johnny's agent in an all-cash deal is something I'll figure out later. It takes about an hour more. But finally, Harris and Laura have dug up three other little safes and unloaded all the do-re-mi into 9 large FedEx boxes. I gather this is not putting much of a dent in their non-traditional banking practices. "We trust you," says Harris warmly as he seals the last box. "Yes, we do," adds Laura, with a criminal capitalist inner peace I'll never forget. "This is our small way of thanking you for all your films," she adds, "and we know Fruitcake will be a hit. But don't change a thing in the script if you don't want to," Harris pipes in jovially. "We don't care if the film makes us our money back or not." "Come on," announces Laura with excitement. "It's time to get you up to the FedEx place. You've got a hitchhiking trip to go on." "And may all your rides be as prosperous as this first one," adds Harris, with financial affection and artistic respect. I embrace my new non-note-giving movie producers, and Harris and I load all the boxes into the trunk of his vehicle. We get in and wave goodbye to Laura, who is already back to potting her perennials like a serenely demented garden club enthusiast. Just as we pull off, a black butterfly lands on her shoulder in a Douglas Sirk way, and she returns the farewell gesture with a smile that could put Julia Roberts out of business. "Did you see Zoo?" Harris suddenly asks once we are on the road, eager to get back to cult film talk. "Sure," I answer with pride, "that arty true crime doc about the man who dies after getting fucked by a horse in Seattle. I toured presenting that film, even showed it at the Sydney Opera House." "That's the one," Harris agrees. "I felt for those guys who were involved," he reasons. "It was a sad story, but told in a dignified way. Did you believe that animal rescue worker who, when interviewed on film after the zoo guys had left the ranch, said she saw a small pony come up and give a bigger horse a blowjob?" "That was bullshit," Harris answers without missing a beat, knowing exactly the scene I was talking about. "I like animals," he continues. "But if that horse had a hard-on and did mount the guy, you can't call the sex act non-consensual, can you? If an animal gets it up, isn't he willing?" Before we can finish this debate, we pull up to the FedEx drop-off store, amazingly subtitled on the sign out front, "Going Postal." Harris informs me that this is the only corrupt FedEx office in the country, and he is their only customer, that he does so much business here, keeps it open and off the map of corporate concern. The clerk inside looks as if he just escaped from a Whole Foods employee jail. His hair is shaved into the FedEx logo, he wears a large nose ring, and UPS is tattooed onto his forehead. His one-time DHL delivery uniform has been sewn together with a regular USPS outfit to create a postmodern attire of a mentally unstable but proud letter carrier. His name patch reads, "Return to Sender." He and Harris are obviously buddies and greet each other with the hipster fist bump. No questions are asked as I fill out all the second-day delivery forms, hoping to not seem too eager on the other end. "Done deal," announces Harris as he pulls out a giant doobie and hands it to return to sender. I guess it's some kind of tip. "Thank you, Harris," I say sincerely outside as we get back into his totally unremarkable car. Don't thank me, he modestly responds as we pull out into traffic, always careful to obey the posted speed limit. Thank the pot smokers all over the Delmarva area. They're the real ones backing your new movie. With that, he pulls over to an entrance ramp on I-70 West and bids me adios. Here's my contact info, he says, handing me a business card printed on the old kind of flash paper that bookies and numbers racket hoods used to use. I read the P.O. box number in Triadelphia, West Virginia, and Harris tells me to read it again and don't forget it. I do. Suddenly, with a flash of light, the business card ignites, turns to ash, and disappears. Happy trails, Harris says as I open the door to get out, suddenly a working film director again, and stick out my thumb. Harris accelerates and, looking at me in the rearview mirror, waves one last time, just as he sees me getting immediately picked up by my next ride. And it's only 2:30 p.m. Good ride number two, KK. Imagine my surprise opening the passenger side front door and seeing a steering wheel above the shotgun seat. Are we in London? I momentarily wonder in confusion. I don't know how far I'm going, but get in, begs a nice middle-aged lady in the driver's seat who wears a modest gray bouffant hairdo that must need weekly maintenance in a beauty parlor. Dressed in pastel suburban-style separates, she could be anybody's mom. I notice the small logo of the AOG Driving School on the exterior of the front door and figure what better hands in which to be driven. I jump in and see the Total Fleet Services brand name displayed on the dashboard of this older, almost vintage vehicle, and realize a second brake is between my feet. My name's KK, she says nervously as I fasten my seatbelt and feel immediate unease as she pulls out too fast and without warning into the slow lane and almost cuts off another car emerging from the entrance ramp. This woman teaches people to drive, I panic, as I hear the blare of other drivers' horns. I'm John, I say politely, and before I can even be glad she has no idea who I am, I involuntarily slam on my brake as she obviously doesn't see the other car ahead of us slowing down, despite the thoughtful motorist pumping of the brake light to alert us. Sorry, I guess I'm just a backseat driver, I mumble with some concern. That's okay, she assures me as she swerves around another car in the slow lane without even putting on her turn signal. I need all the help I can get. As the harrowing ride continues, I take more and more control over the wheel, and she seems to be relieved. I'm not really a driving instructor, she finally volunteers after another close call, when I could mercifully swerve from my side without having to reach across and grab her wheel. But why do you have this car? I ask in bewilderment. It's a long story, but there's nothing else I could do, she gasps, looking suddenly as if she's going to cry. Before I can quiz her further, I hear a muffled banging coming from the rear of the car, which gives me newfound concern. It's the brake pad, she volunteers without conviction. We'll be okay. Hearing a thumping noise that causes further concern, I tell her, we need to pull over. Something must be hanging off the car. Don't stop, she snaps with sudden seriousness as she instead turns on the radio at high volume. Transfusion, a longtime favorite of mine by Nervous Norvis, comes on. And this 50s novelty song with the lyrics, I'm never, never, never gonna speed again, followed by the sound of a horrible car crash, gives me the courage to defy her. Why not? I cry over the music as I start to steer us toward the exit for the upcoming family rest area, and she, for the first time, steers her wheel in the opposite direction. I put on the brakes to slow down for a construction site ahead, but she floors the accelerator, hits the cones, and sends the panicked construction workers scattering for safety. Please, mister, she suddenly pleads, changing her tack. Don't pull over. I have to get to my sister's, and she lives near Columbus, Ohio. We'll get you there, I assure her, trying to distract her by hastily assuming the role of instructor and reaching over to turn on the windshield wipers and defrost her to show her how they work. But KK won't give up the battle. Our car is swerving dangerously back and forth on the highway, driven by different wills. The noise from the rear end of the car seems to be getting worse, too. Is it just my ears playing a trick on me, or did I just hear someone yell, help? Finally giving up, she turns down the radio, takes her hands completely off the wheel, and lets me steer the car to a parking space in the next roadside travel plaza. It's not my fault, she says to me with newfound sorrow. What's not your fault, I demand. About the same time I hear a man's voice yell, you dumb bitch, let me out. Fuck you, asshole, she suddenly snarls, turning toward the back of the car with a ferocious anger that seems completely out of character. "Women drivers," a gruff voice yells back, and I realize, good Lord, somebody's in the trunk. Drama. Just what I've been hoping for. How perfect for my book. "I'm a single lady," she suddenly sobs to me, back in character, as I turn off the ignition to listen, not sure what else I can do. "All I wanted was to learn to drive," she continues in agitation. "But no, this chauvinist pig starts quizzing me about my opinion on abortion in the first lesson." "Abortion makes you the mother of a dead baby," the voice in the trunk butts in. "I asked God and she's pro-choice," yells back my apparently militant feminist driving partner with an anger I would never have expected. "Look, I agree with you," I try to explain to KK, hoping to calm her down. "I like kids," I continue. "But my abortion politics are simple. If you can't love your child, don't have it because it will grow up and kill me." She nods her head in relieved agreement. "But still, you can't keep this guy in the trunk," I try to reason. "Who's that faggot?" yells our hostage with a rudeness that instantly pushes me over the edge. "You filthy impregnator," I shout back, suddenly as combative as KK. "How dare you tell a woman what to do with her body?" "That's right, you fallopian tube fascist," KK joins in with such rage that the veins in her forehead pop out and her hairdo partially collapses. "Cocksucker whore," yells our fanatical pro-lifer, banging on the inside of the trunk lid so loudly that a family exiting their car nearby looks over in suspicion. "I wish I was a girl so I could get an abortion," I yell in ridiculous reactionary rhetoric as the mom, dad, and kids quickly hightail it to the food area, convinced I'm just a crazy person with Tourette's syndrome. "All I wanted to do was to learn to parallel park," KK begins railing to me. "But no, he has to start in on my sexual politics. I've never even had an abortion. But even if I had, it's private. I shouldn't have to discuss my reproductive organs with a driving instructor, should I?" Before I can answer, she spins in her seat like Linda Blair's head in The Exorcist and begins addressing her captive. "Should I, you asshole horn dog?" she screams with a venomous hatred of all things sexually unfair, before adding the final insult. "With humans, it's abortion, but with chickens, it's an omelet. What do you have to say about that, you yellow-bellied coward?" KK's radical sloganizing does the trick. "Coward? Coward," he bellows back. "You call someone who bomb Planned Parenthood a coward? I'm an Army of God warrior. I am the sperm guardian of the universe." Suddenly, he's quiet. He knows this time his big mouth has done him in. KK blinks in sudden recognition and whispers victoriously to me, "AOG driving school. Oh, my God. It's a front for the Army of God, the Christian terrorist group." Then she adds, loud enough for him to hear, "He ain't calling the police on anyone." I see a Trailways bus with a posted destination of Dayton, Ohio, pull up and let out some passengers for a pit stop, and I think fast. "Okay, KK, we're going to get you out of this car, and I'm going to get you on that bus. Dayton's past Columbus. You'll get to your sister's. Give me the keys." She hands them over without a peep, and I'm relieved to see there's a trunk release button. KK breathes a little bit easier now that her driving lesson from hell has finally ended. We both get out and slam the car door shut. Suddenly, we hear a less militant voice from the truck. "Okay, look, I didn't mean that," he snivels. "Let's just try to end this misunderstanding without problems. Let me out, and we'll all go our separate ways. Let's agree to disagree. I could be wrong. I apologize. You're not that bad behind the wheel, Miss KK. With a few more lessons, you're going to be a legally licensed driver." KK laughs out loud for the first time, and I see that she really is a moderate person who was baited into a political fervor she never knew lurked inside her. She now seems proud of herself, strong, ready to move on, and I let her abortion rights road rage simmer down. I take her hand and lead her towards the bus. The driver, surely against company policy, is not guarding the front door, but has instead joined some of his more out-of-shape passengers in a cigarette break, while others remain in their seats dozing, and the rest line up for artery-clogging Cinnabon treats inside the pavilion. Since he has to pass through Dayton, I have no trouble distracting the driver with phony questions about the best route there, and KK sneaks aboard his bus with ease. I aim the trunk release at the driving instructor's car, and the trunk opens, almost as if it were surprising the other cars parked nearby. Slowly, the pro-lifer sits up inside and peers out wearily. Realizing the authorities are not there to grab him, he immediately reverts to his fanaticism, grabs a handful of Equal Rights for Unborn Women flyers, jumps out and begins aggressively approaching unsuspecting families who have stopped to stretch their limbs or take a whiz inside. Get away, snaps a woman with two howling children and a lughead husband who makes no move to help her. Undeterred, our driving instructor approaches another harried family who look worse for the wear as they return to their car after visiting the snack bar. Why is mommy crying? The young boy asks his dad, all sugared up and bewildered with concern. Because you're an asshole, barks back the father with exasperated logic. Suddenly, our clueless agitator butts in, chanting, birth control is for wimps, before thrusting a flyer into the humiliated kid's hands with a complete lack of human understanding. Eat me, yells the son with a sudden untapped rage before kicking the pro-lifer as hard as he can on the balls. The whole family, suddenly united in the face of unwanted intrusion, screams in derisive laughter as Mr. Big Mouth limps away, holding his sperm-filled, baby-making family jewels. I look over at KK. She has seen what I just saw. I could never make this shit up. And I think for the first time she realizes that she has somehow helped me. I smile at her in mutual creative respect, and she waves goodbye, happy to have been a positive inspiration to someone. Her bus pulls off toward Columbus and real life with her sister, where our little adventure will never be mentioned. I walk out to the exit ramp and decide to try a second version of my hitchhike sign, Midlife Crisis. I stick out my thumb, confident that roadside reality will bring me more perfect material. Good ride number 3. Lucas. I'm thrilled the first few cars don't pick me up, so I have time to gather my thoughts. The passing drivers are nice, making hand gestures explaining they are only going a short way, or more elaborate ones that I can only assume mean they're turning off in a direction other than west. My luck not only continues, it does a backflip and lands perfectly beside me like a hitchhiking guardian angel. A beat-up beige 1965 Ford F500 flatbed truck screeches to a halt right in the middle of the ramp without the slightest concern for the impatient drivers behind, who must be pissed at having to stop. But they don't have the courage to honk their horns. Because on the flatbed truck is a Ford Vic 1970 station wagon that has been customized for a demolition derby. Whiplash is spray-painted by hand in huge, scary letters on both sides with the car's local sponsor, Thumper Bumper, which I guess may be an auto repair shop, and Ass Car, God only knows what that means, is scrawled on the hood. Tetanus Tattoo Parlor completes the advertising on the tailgate. Painted in black on the driver's side is his entry number, 422. Good God, April 22nd. That's my birthday. I peer inside the truck just to scope out the driver. I'm thrilled to be getting another ride so quickly, but still, first impressions count, and I want to be as safe as I can on this intrinsically unsafe trip. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, shouts the driver. I'm Lucas. Hop in. Thanks, I say, climbing inside, thrilled to hear that roughneck highway song, Looking at the World Through a Windshield by Del Reeves playing on the radio. Jesus Christ, you were on The Simpsons, he yells over the unmuffled sound of his truck's engine, pulling off and entering I-70 West. Yeah, that's me, John Waters, I admit modestly. Homer's Phobia, he correctly yells out my episode's title with a roar of laughter. I notice his two gold front teeth, so rare yet appealing in a white guy. His tight denim blue jeans splattered with grease, scruffy white motorcycle boots, and a raggedy thrift shop 50 sports shirt patterned with cartoon car crash graphics only add to his renegade debonair charm. Feeling comfortable with my new ride, I break my rule and mention I'm also a film director, and he asks, which ones? As he guns ahead down the highway, passing cars right and left, but driving safely. Hairspray, I mention, but he gives me a blank look. Pink Flamingos, I try, and get the same vacant expression. Crybaby? Cereal, mom, I offer, but no luck. Nah, he answers without embarrassment, I only like cartoons. I switch the subject to Lucas' life and tell him what a fan of demolition derbies I am. How I long ago covered one on air as a pundit for that radio show All Things Considered, and how I had recently attended another derby outside Baltimore, and how surprised I had been at one of the side events before the race began. A used car in good condition sat in a fenced-in area as customers lined up and paid admission to enter, mostly dads and their younger male children. Each was handed a sledgehammer, and the clock would start ticking, and the father-son team had 3 minutes to beat the car and cause as much damage as possible. Great work, son, a dad would congratulate Junior after he managed to smash the windshield. Rip it up, Pop, a kid would yelp as his father knocked off a rearview mirror with one easy swipe. There were no prizes, only quality wrecking time with your family, and this seemed to be reward enough. The crumpled, ruined auto lay there, abandoned and dead. I wondered whose responsibility it was to haul away the carcass. Is there such a thing as post-production demolition derbies? "It's fucking maniac night," Lucas explains, "and tonight I'm gonna win. We're gonna tear him up," he hollers humorously, meaning him and his car. I want to go too. Almost magically, as if he could read my mind like Kreskin, he smiles that sexy gold-tooth smile and leers in a friendly growl with a faint southern accent. "Want to ride in the car with me?" "Sure," I stammer, wishing I was wearing those slip-on fronts I had made for my teeth in Baltimore with JW and fake jewels. "But are you allowed to have passengers?" I ask. "Hell no," he replies, "but since when have I done what is allowed? But it will be late at night if I stay for the race, and then I'll have to hitchhike in the dark, and I'll be nervous," I admit with shame. "Stay with me, snake," he hisses with a male friendliness that is confusing in its undefined sexual connotations. "I'm custom fit, hammered, and bent just like your boy Homer." I gulp. "You're going to be my good luck charm," he announces with a flirtatious grin. I am swooning with excitement when we finally get to Marengo, Indiana, having so much fun riding with Lucas that I barely notice it's already night. We've come a long way as we pull up at the Crawford County 4-H Fairgrounds. Maniac night sounds even better when you read it off a weather-worn wooden marquee, especially with a $1,200 prize added below. Lucas knows everybody. There's Anteater and Doo-Doo, two scary grease monkeys who obviously idolize my new best friend, and they help him get Whiplash off the flatbed truck and up near to the pit gate. I see a lot of other junker cars with souped-up names such as Rat Rod, Gunt Hunt, Hatchet Head, and Head On Hard On, which it was explained will be disqualified because of its unfamily-friendly name. There's even one named Whitney Houston. I don't know about Lucas, but I've got a winning feeling building inside me. As our heat approaches, Lucas sneaks me in under a fence, and I climb in through our car's front passenger side window because the doors are now welded shut. He hands me goggles, a helmet with Whiplash hand-stenciled on the front just like his, and a crumpled jumpsuit to put over my usual low-key come-de-garçon outfit that I have chosen to wear for the trip. "Material's fireproof," he explains, "and since the family business my dad started is fire protection, I feel relieved as I struggle to suit up." As he slips into his own matching outfit, he catches me peeking in his naturally toned chest and winks. "Watch," he says, as he pours lighter fluid all over his jumpsuit. "Go ahead," he orders me as he hands me a box of kitchen matches from under his seat. "Set me on fire." I hesitate, then strike one and toss it on him. His outfit immediately goes up in flames, but he just laughs, feeling no pain. He waits a full 15 seconds before he smothers out the blaze. Lucas is my action hero. There is no glass in Whiplash. The windshield and the rear and side windows have been removed. Most of the interior has been dismantled, and the gas tank is now in the back where the seats once were. As I reach for the safety belt, Lucas snarls from behind the wheel, "Seat belt's optional," and looks down to his crotch and points to the seat belt buckle that once was on his driver's side but has now been redesigned into his belt for fashion. Being the wimp I evidently am, I slip on both the helmet and the seat belt that is, thank God, still attached on the passenger side. I look over the dirt oval track with all the junkers' taillights facing each other and see Rat Rod, a 70s Dodge Charger with this disgusting slob of a driver inside, taking a big gulp of whiskey from a bottle, which I'm sure is against the rules. He glances at me and then catches Lucas's eyes, too, and begins making mock kissing noises with his brittle, chapped lips. I avert my eyes as Lucas snorts in derision, grabs his own dick, and squeezes it in excitement of possible revenge. "That sandbagging asshole," he growls, "always holding back, lurking around the side of the ring, too cowardly to strike first." I smell gasoline fumes, and am in seventh heaven. "Will death strike tonight?" the track announcer yells over the loudspeaker system that booms out to the entire fairgrounds. As the crowd cheers and the drivers rev their engines, the countdown begins. 10, 9.